Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. All of us know Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation, and we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, whatever your sexual orientation, your gender, or your family structure. And we welcome you no matter what your age, young or old, your abilities or your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a large variety of services. They're presented either by a Prairie member or a member of the wider community, and that's true today. Today, we'll be having Patrick Farabaugh presenting Becoming an LGBT Advocate. Opening words will be read by Patty Stockdale.
We are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness. Bitch Hut Hun.
Please welcome Estrella Donald to light the chalice.
The best thing about coming out is it's totally liberating. You feel like you've made this incredible discovery about yourself, and you want to share it and be open and honest and not spend all your time wondering about how this person is going to react, or should I be careful around this person, or what will the neighbors say? And it's more. It's about getting past the question of what's wrong with me to knowing there's nothing wrong, that you were born this way. You're a normal person and a beautiful person, and you should be proud of who you are. You deserve to live with dignity and show people your pride.
I'd like to introduce our speaker, Patrick Farabaugh, who is going to be talking to us about becoming an LGBT advocate. LGBT, by the way, stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender advocate, in case there was anyone that didn't know that. I'm on Facebook, and I kept seeing Patrick Farabaugh on my friends' list. Friends of friends, you know. Who is this guy? Well, now I know. Patrick Farabaugh has worked in national media and publishing for 16 years, and he got his start working for Time Incorporated magazine, Entertainment Weekly. And he's since helped drive the creative for Out magazine, which is the Vanity Fair of the National Gay Press. Also for Seattle magazine, and he was a senior creative for Condé Nast Publishing while at Condé Nast Traveler. Since arriving in Wisconsin in 2005, Farabaugh has founded the Madison Gay Hockey Association. You look right back there in the corner, you can see he's probably going to be a pretty good hockey player. also, Our Lives magazine and Open, which is the Out Professional and Executive Network. He's also consulted with area corporations like Dean, Promega, Kraft, and others on how to better tap into LGBT talent and business. And in 2009, he also worked for In Business magazine, helping them to rebrand both their print magazine and ibmadison.com website. Just a little bit more about him. Under his leadership, Our Lives magazine has grown into a thriving and trusted voice, both in the local market and nationally. What drives his vision for the brand is to make a resource that celebrates leadership and living authentically. So then in 2011, last year, he also began hosting a weekly radio companion on Clear Channel Radio's The Mic 92.1 called Being Authentic. So I'd like to ask Patrick to come up and tell us what he's got to say about being an advocate.
I can't tell you how many of these I've done, and I can tell you it never gets easier getting up in front of strangers. And part of that, I think, is because I'm not getting up here giving a business presentation. I think I'm getting up here to tell you my personal story, which, you know, I think is the biggest change agent that you can have or provide for, you know, having people understand what it's like to be different or, you know, in someone else's shoes. So that said, I'll tell you a bit about me. I grew up just outside Gary, Indiana. I was born in the late 70s. And you can imagine what it must have been like trying to figure out who you are, especially if that who you are is gay in the 80s in Gary, Indiana. It was not a very friendly place to try to discover and come into yourself. As a child, I knew pretty young that something was really different. And by child, I mean by third grade, however old you are in third grade. Around that time period, I started to notice a real distinct separation between myself and the other kids. And that caused me to really retreat and become very introverted and shy. And it really limited how I interacted with the other kids in my class, because here was this thing that was making me insecure. I noticed I wasn't having the same self-esteem or confidence as the other kids because I had these doubts and I didn't have anybody to talk to about them. And by sixth or seventh grade, so a couple years later, there was a mental hospital in our town that I used to probably once a month go crying to my mom and dad asking them to put me in, because there were things that I felt were wrong with me that I couldn't talk to them about. And they never would do that, you know, not unless I could actually tell them or give them a reason why. And clearly I was not going to tell to tell them, because again, Gary, and where there's a real big difference between Gary, Indiana, and here, I think in the economic engines of the city, Gary had the steel mills, which were collapsing, didn't have nearly the access to education. And I think without those things, you didn't really have a culture of tolerance. And tolerance is step one. You gotta take a couple more steps before you get to acceptance, you know, or even a couple steps farther before you're affirming. So Gary was nowhere near tolerance. Like, any message that I was given by the people that I looked up to and considered my role models often, you know, didn't really make me feel that good about myself, is probably the best way to say it. Most of the things they did made me more scared of who I was becoming. And if you think of it, all of the struggles a child has, you need somebody to talk to. And when something that's this core to who you are, you can't talk to anybody about, not your friends, not your parents, not even, that's really isolating and really creates a pretty lonely life for a child. Around 16, I met somebody that I fell in love with, which are as much in love as you can be at 16. And we were the same age. And all I can remember was, for the first time, I felt normal in my life, which was a real revelation, because I don't think other people, you know, grow up even having to think about those things. You just are. So, and that went on for a while, but when we kind of got discovered as trying to create a relationship, his parents really... I don't know a nice way to say it. They just lost it. His mother went borderline, you know, just chaotic. Within a day or two, they had his name changed, and they had him on a flight to a reparative therapy church in the South. And then I remember hearing about this through the grapevine, just people whispers in the school, and going over to his house, you know, pretty distraught myself, trying to figure out what was going on, and his mother screaming at me through the window. She wouldn't open the window. That she had lost your son because of me, that she was gonna warn the town and tell my family. And if you can imagine that, now after dealing with all these things, as a child, by yourself, finding some sort of sanctuary or solace and having that pretty traumatically ripped from you, and also at the same time that you're beginning to understand what love feels like, that's a lot to deal with as a kid. And sadly, I knew that my parents would react pretty much the same way. If they knew. I went back and tried to hide it pretty hard for about a year. I fell probably into the deepest depression of my life, as you would imagine. And again, this is pre the internet. The internet didn't really start to even become a consumer product until the mid 90s. So there weren't a lot of resources that I could find to even know there were other people out there like me. So it was still a very isolating thing to be able to identify and figure out who you are if you are somewhere, you know, under the LGBT rainbow. And I remember going into my mother taking me into like a 7-Eleven style store in our hometown and seeing a magazine rack. And in this magazine rack, there was a copy of Entertainment Weekly, which at the time was a really thriving large magazine, you know, on the same level as like People magazine. And I laugh now, but it was Barbara Streisand on the cover of this. And I didn't know who she was, let alone that she was a gay icon. But what I did remember was seeing this magazine that had this person on the cover, and this magazine was celebrating her for not being like everybody else, which is something that I really felt would, if I was different at all, I ran the risk in Gary of being killed. I knew people who had been killed. I knew people who had been carjacked. I knew people who had been shot at. Just that's the reality of Gary. So, you know, you have a chance at a good life in Gary if you can make yourself look like everybody else. If you look different at all, you were in trouble. So I saw this magazine that was celebrating people for being different, and I knew if I had any hope of having a life that I would actually like to live, I needed to find a way to find mentors and role models and people that could teach me how to get to that place. And made a plan and disappeared pretty much overnight myself and ran away to New York and convinced them to hire me, and they hired me when I was 18. So that itself wasn't without its own struggle. I did end up homeless for a while. I was sleeping on the street in a cardboard box on the steps of a Latino church on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, for anybody that knows, and this is in the mid-90s at this point. And So once I arrive in New York, now my world has changed. One of the things I like to explain to people is you fill your life with all these people who influence and shape who you are, but if something happens that causes you to press the reset button and you push all those people out of your world, you've created room for a whole new family of people to teach and shape you. And I was at a pretty impressionable age still. You know, I'm still a teenager at this stage. And I feel like in some ways I won the lottery, because the people who came into my life at that stage really played a pretty significant role and had a lot of influence in my life. As I was getting over being homeless, I was discovered by the people that do the television show The Real World, if anyone's heard of this. Again, this is 15 years ago. And the producers were salivating at the chance of a plot line around a gay homeless youth. you can imagine why, because there's a little bit of drama that comes with living that kind of life. And I need to say also, if you want to know how disproportionately homelessness is in this country, especially among youth, so think of all the homeless youth in the country, 40% identify as being gay. So that, like, in the general population, the gay population is less than 10% of society. I would say maybe somewhere around 5%, but 40% of the homeless youth identify as being gay. So, and understandably so, I lived that life. While I was going through the real world stuff, and crazy that is, and probably you all are familiar with the expression family of choice. Those people became my family of choice before I even knew what a family of choice was. So the cast members from the early seasons of the show saw how vulnerable I was and how the producers were salivating at the chance to exploit my vulnerability, and really rallied around and became my family and took on the responsibility of becoming those mentors and those teachers. And, you know, some of the girls from the London season became my moms, essentially. One of the guys from the Miami season became my business partner and became my best friend and mentor. And his best friend is Steve Wozniak, who maybe you've heard of, maybe you haven't. For those who haven't, he founded Apple. And I felt like I won the lottery, because when I cleared out my life of all those people who made me feel like I was living in a shell of who I could be, it made room for all these people to come into my world and really create and give me the chance to thrive. Now, what I was struggling with still was reconciling being gay. And the why I was struggling with this so much was around gender issues, because at that time, the only people that you could see, if you're familiar with like the expression cultural competence, my cultural competence wasn't at a place where I could see the well-adjusted, out gay person. The only people that I knew how to see, or that were visible to me at that time with my very limited emotional maturity, were the real extremes. So if a man was really flamboyant or eccentric, I probably knew that he was gay. If a woman was really masculine or butch, I knew that she was probably a lesbian. I didn't know how to see anything except those bookends. And it scared me because I was always very masculine. Walking around trying to find any sense of community in New York, I would, like, first of all, it's really hard to live in Manhattan and be under 21. So, that city was designed for, nightlife is a very core piece of the culture there, and to not have access to any of that, which I didn't want it for drinking or anything like that. I wanted it for a social connection to other people. And it was how I knew to find those people. So I would walk past these bars or things at night, and I would see the people intoxicated, stumbling out, using pretty lewd sexual humor things. And what that did is it made me isolate even more. I struggled because I saw these people who were part of my community, but that I couldn't relate with. And it scared me because that it wasn't necessarily what I wanted to be. So it made me withdraw quite a bit more. One of the things that I can say about the gay community and going through a process like this is you develop critical thinking skills that are off the charts because you learn to question everything and form your own opinions. There's very little that you just adopt and go with, what you're told. You really, at your core, search for who you are, who the authentic you is, and you don't just adopt anything that people tell you. Somehow, along these lines, I ended up at an event where I met someone named Kevin Jennings. Kevin Jennings went on, he saw the same way a parent can look at their child, and that parent can tell what is bothering a child often before the child has really worked it out and figured it out. He saw I was struggling with these gender issues, that I couldn't reconcile being a masculine man and being gay. And he played on a gay hockey team in New York City, and thought that that would be a great vehicle to pull me out socially and at least get me around other gay people. And that's exactly what he did. Some really cool biographical information on Kevin. And again, this falls in line with that winning the lottery. Kevin founded an organization called GLSEN. GLSEN is the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network. And what they did is they went into all of the states and set up these models for the high school GSA clubs. So he founded the national body of that and left that position to go be the Deputy Secretary of Education for President Obama. So again, the winning lottery ticket in that sense. The hockey team that he pulled me on transformed my life. It got me around other gay people. It gave me time to come to terms with who I was on my own terms. I could tell people for the first time that I was playing hockey and that I was learning about, this sport without having to come out and tell them that I was gay. I was able to instead just say I was a hockey player, but it got me around other gay people, which gave me the opportunity to just learn about my own culture more and see the diversity in my own culture more. And I had quite the rock star hockey team. Besides Kevin, I had Cindy Lauper's husband on my team. So it turns out they didn't live far from me, so Cindy and David were often my rides to the games. Which, I don't know if anyone's ever heard Cindy Lauper talk, but she has the thickest Long Island accent that you will ever. And oftentimes, they would be mid-conversation in the front seat, talking like an old married couple, and Cindy would turn around to ask for my opinion, and I couldn't recognize the language they were speaking. Just because it was so thick. But like I said, this gave me a chance to really sort of come alive and come into my own. Hockey in many ways became my anti-drug. I think a lot of people, when you're faced with the level of stress that gay youth or gay people in general go under, buckle and try to self-medicate through, either tobacco or drugs or any of these other things to try to escape the torment of the reality. Well, that's what hockey became for me. Once I discovered it, I was on the ice for sometimes 5 nights a week. So it was my way of escaping reality and buying me time to process and learn and develop how I understood who I was in this world. That said, being a runaway, one of the things that's really challenging is you've learned at a young age that running away can solve a problem. And it's really hard to let go of that that problem-solving solution. So the way I like to explain it is, if you think of a dandelion that you pick and you blow it and it scatters everywhere, that was me. Once I'd lost my roots, I went wherever the wind did. And every time things got too hard, I ended up packing up and going somewhere else, convincing myself that I wasn't leaving because of a problem. I was leaving because I had this greater opportunity somewhere else. And when all was said and done, I ended up living in 7 states and a couple countries. So really all over the world, and scattered all over the U.S. from the Northeast to the West Coast to Alaska to, you know, the South a little bit. And then internationally in Canada, and I lived with a tribe in West Africa for a while. And one of the major relationships in my life, I fell for a Russian and moved to Siberia. So, as this progresses, and the mentors and role models that I have help me find my voice, which I think is critical to be able to eventually become an advocate, I got discovered by Condé Nast, which is the home of Vogue, Vanity Fair, GQ, The New Yorker, Gourmet, all these titles. And I think if anyone's seen the movie The Devil Wears Prada, maybe you have, maybe you haven't, but it was based on my boss in New York. So did that for years, fell for the Russian, moved to Siberia. In the process, I left out a very critical piece. When I ran away, when I arrived in New York, once I finally felt like I had the safety of knowing that I was in charge of my own life and I couldn't have a rug ripped out from under me, I came out to my family. And I came out to my mother. And she proceeded to bar me from talking to anybody else for about 10 years in the family, which is fully what I expected. And that was really what did a lot of the house cleaning that created room for those other people to come in. The very, very fractured and fragmented conversations I would have with my family over the next 10 years, there was so much off limits that I couldn't talk about that I didn't feel like they knew anything about me. So they certainly knew. I could have been a generic person, a telemarketer, calling them for what they knew. And that created a real separation. It almost is like a child who's adopted and then quite later finds his birth family. When you find your birth family, you have to discover what you have in common with them all over again, or if you have anything in common with them. And that's the position that I was in. 10 years later, I fall for this Russian, I go to Russia, and my mother has this realization at that point in time that what was causing her to lose her child was the fact that I didn't have any ties that were keeping me here. And she had been a big proponent of me not having those ties. You know, she prevented me from being able to grow relationships with the people that I grew up around because she limited what they were allowed to know about me. So she, in this epiphanal moment, started telling everybody, you know, all the way down to like the checkout clerk at the grocery store, just thinking very quickly that if she could create these opportunities for ties, that I wouldn't leave. And the problem was the tickets were already bought. I had already fallen for someone. It came a little bit too late. I go to Russia. If anyone knows anything about Russia, you think gay people have it hard here. This is an oasis compared to Russia, where only until a few years ago, they were still very actively imprisoning people that were known homosexuals. The stress of the culture crushed the relationship. Thankfully, we ended it on good terms. He's still very close to me. He's flown over to America to visit a few times and has met my family since. But when I came back to New York, I came back feeling very lost. I come back to New York from Russia, and one of the girls who had done the TV show The Real World in London went to go work for Morgan Spurlock, the man that did the movie Super Size Me, who decided he was going to intervene and try to document reuniting me with my family. And that was enough of a catalyst to at least move back to the Midwest and begin trying to build the bridge with them. Going back to the hockey league part, and what I think was absolutely critical was it gave me an opportunity to celebrate who I am for the first time in my life. And when I came to Wisconsin, none of those tools were here. There was certainly leadership within the gay community and the opportunity for mentors and role models, but there were no vehicles that could connect you to those people. So you didn't have a way to connect or find them. And I had a teacher at once say something that stuck with me, and he said, a luxury is only a luxury until you own it, and that's when it becomes a necessity. So, and I had all these tools in the New York community that helped me develop who I am, that coming here, when they didn't exist, I wasn't ready to go on without them. And obviously, if they're not there, then the burden's on your shoulders to create it. And that led to creating the Hockey League in town as what I call a huge Trojan horse. Like, hockey was just the actual horse itself, the actual use of the group, and what I see the purpose of it being, was a socially constructive, like, peer mentoring, big brothers, big sisters program that could connect people under the model of, you know, that there's this mentoring program. And it exploded because of that. We have about 120 skaters now, which makes us the biggest hockey league in the city, gay or straight. And the leadership models that I saw floating up from that are what led to the magazine, because whether I like it or not, not everybody likes hockey. So the magazine gave me the opportunity to make that a much larger umbrella and give people the opportunity and a narrative voice. I publish a magazine called Our Lives, where people tell their own stories. And I think for a community that's had to bear so much shame, which manifests as internalized homophobia, the most liberating and empowering thing you can do is hear somebody own their own words as they're finding the courage to be their own advocate and tell their own story. And that's what the magazine's created an opportunity for a lot of those leaders to do. My next cover goes to press, my next magazine goes to press in a couple days, and it's Mark Pocan on the cover, telling part of his political story, but it's more his coming out story and how, where he found his voice was that he had survived a hate crime, that he had been the victim of getting pretty badly beaten up at one point for being gay. And the magazine's really the only vehicle out there that helps connect those dots and creates an opportunity to learn and grow and hear those stories. So I want to wrap this up pretty soon, but one of the things I like to say, and what I think what I've learned, at least in my life, that makes us who we are, is typically, if you look at mythology, and I think the modern form of mythology is comic books. So typically when you look at a superhero or a figure who is a superhero, they've gone through some super level of trauma or suffering. And oftentimes, I'll use Batman as example, it's a piece of that trauma or suffering that ends up becoming what the super version of them is. So Batman fell down this hole and was traumatized by all these bats, which in turn he drew his superpower from. I think part of, for my story, what I went through and the trauma that had surrounded my coming out experience and when I was a teenager is what has made this my life work. So, and I think that's tandem. The greatness on one side, I think, is totally tandem to the suffering on the other. And I think you need that for balance as a person. So if you look at how much somebody may suffer, that's probably to find their own balance pushes them to the other extreme at the other end. I will say, and then I'll be done. I spent 7 years searching for my first love when he was ripped away. Because without anyone to tell you it's not your fault, I fully believed it was my fault. And found him after 7 years. They had never sent him to school, back to school, so he never finished high school. The church that he was in had brainwashed him into believing that he had a social responsibility to take on a wife and a family, which he did as well. And talking to him, he had developed like this thick Southern accent, which to me sounded like just it was this arrested development in action of who he was. The only moments of enthusiasm in his voice that I heard were when we were talking about how amazing it was that we were talking to each other again. What that did for me when I hung up the phone, because this was a telephone call, it helped me understand that now he has a life, his choices are made, and I was free to go on with my own life. And that's what I did. Fast forward now, again, another 7 years, 14 years now since this happened, and I go on and create this magazine. I made a very personal decision to drive all over the state and down to Chicago to personally hand out the first issue of the magazine. And this was 4th of July weekend in 2007 when it launched. And I took a break. I was carrying all these around in a backpack, and I took a break in Boys Town in Chicago, and I popped into an IHOP, if anybody knows an IHOP on Halstead Street, and sat down to get a glass of water and looked up, and he was sitting across. I'm telling it in code in each issue of the magazine. I put a little piece of my story in, but it's fairly cryptic. So I'll tell you, one of the saddest things is I knew a lot of other transient kids, and I don't know any of them now, which makes me think, for the most part, they didn't end up as well. You know, and I do feel like a lot of luck was involved, a lot of serendipity. That's a good question. One of the things that I think whenever you look at the struggles of an oppressed minority is they often need allies in the majority. So one of the people that I read and study is Tim Weiss, who is a white anti-racist. And I think there is certainly a lot of work and a lot of carbonating that can come from that movement to show where the opportunity is for people to be, you know, straight allies of the LGBT movement. So you can kind of kill two birds with one stone by Googling his name. When I made the decision to move back to the Midwest, larger cities, I think, have a toxic element to their gay male communities. And typically those cities that are able to support an enclave, like a gay neighborhood, often have very large populations. And I think people in those environments have the ability to fall under the radar of anonymity a little too much, to the point where I think you grow from accountability. And if you're in a city large enough on a social level to always escape accountability, you don't necessarily always have the opportunity to grow or the push to grow. So leaving New York, I wanted to go to a city that, although I knew there would certainly be painful moments, would force accountability on me. And within a radius of what I thought would be acceptable for driving to get to know my family, that put Madison and Indianapolis there. And I scouted both. And when I saw how core to the identity hockey was to Madison, the decision made itself. I know a bit about her. I know currently everything that post being famous. I know pre being famous, she came from, she doesn't come from privilege, which I think most people might be surprised by, but she came from actually fairly disadvantaged. And to keep her ground, at least for her, to keep her grounded, she still lives in the little walk-up, you know, studio apartment that she was in while she was going through all the struggle trying to make a name for herself. And part of the being authentic piece that I had talked about earlier, there are certain things that I've held on to as core to who I am. I am, at my core, still a kid on the wrong side of the tracks. So I'm very uncomfortable with the tie on me. Because it just feels like a world that I didn't come from. And for me to know who I am and to really stay true to at least where I was brought up. But I see a lot of that in her, too. Okay.